talk about the spinal cord, nerves, and reflexes. We're on the beach today, and they're trimming some trees from the coconuts. So we might hear a little bit of, the song in action and all that stuff, but that's okay. You know, even a bad day at the beach is still a good day. So when we talk about the spinal cord, we realize that it's really going to be an information highway. Picture 595 going from Weston to Fort Lauderdale, and that's going to be like that's going to be a highway carrying cars, and they're going to be getting off at certain exits. And so, too, the same thing with the spinal cord. It's an information highway between the brain and the body. So the body is going to need the information that the brain is going to provide, as well as the body is going to be able to tell the brain about the environment. So it's really a two-way street, literally. So the spinal cord is protected by the vertebral column, meninges, and also cerebral spinal fluid. We'll talk more about that. But remember, when we talk about the vertebral column, we talked about the body of the vertebrae, and that's going to be anterior. And then posteriorly is going to be the pedicles. If you remember, they attach to the body. And then you have the transverse processes, then you have the lamina, and then you have the spinous process. So those guys are going to create what we call the neural arch, or a protective bony area for the spinal cord. Now, when we look at the spinal cord, we see that it's going to begin as a continuation of the medulla oblongata. So when we look at the brain stem, which we'll talk about later, we'll see that the medulla oblongata is going to be the lower part of the brain stem, and then it's going to directly connect to the spinal cord and terminates about L1 vertebrae. Now, L1, as you know, is going to be just the first lumbar vertebrae. So the spinal cord doesn't get any further down. So it's as thick as your finger. And the idea is that when we were just kids, when we were just infants, our spinal cord probably filled up the whole spine. But as we grew, the spine, of course, grew as well. And as we grew, then, of course, the spinal cord itself started to move slowly. Now, there are cervical and lumbar enlargements. These serve as points of origin for nerves to the extremities. So in the cervical area, we're going to see an enlargement. In the lumbar area of the spinal cord, we're going to see an enlargement. But we can't see an enlargement in the lumbar area of the spine, because the spinal cord moves up to L1. So the lumbar enlargement is almost a misnomer. It contains the lumbar and sacral nerves. That's why they call it the lumbar enlargement. But if you think about it, really the anatomy tells us that really the lumbar enlargement is really in the lower thoracics. But why do we have these enlargements? Well, first of all, for the cervical enlargement, it's because of the fact that we need to use our hands, and we need to have a lot of nerves going to our hands. So we would expect that area to be thicker, as well as our lower extremity needs lots of nerves as well. So the cervical and lumbar enlargement serves both the arms and the legs, respectively. Now, there's 31 pairs of spinal nerves. So there's going to be 31 nerves on either side of the spine going to different areas. Now, the distal end of the spinal cord is tapered. We call this the cauda equina, or the horse's tail. Cauda means horse, cauda means tail, equina means horse. So it's going to be the horse's tail or the north part of a southbound horse. Now, some functions of the spinal cord are going to be conduction, locomotion, and also reflexes. Conduction is going to be the bundle of fibers passing information up and down the spinal cord. We'll call these tracks later on. And that's that information highway that we just mentioned. Locomotion is going to be walking, including repetitive, coordinated actions of several muscle groups. So the function of the spinal cord is going to allow us to move. And reflexes are going to be giving information from the outside to the inside. So this is going to involve the peripheral nerves and the spinal cord. So these are involuntary responses to stimuli, but they're usually going to be protective. So an example would be a withdrawal reflex. So you have a young child, and he really likes the top of the stove, how pretty it is. It's like a nice blue light, and it flickers, and it has a little bit of yellow there, you know, and he puts his hand on it because he's so delighted by it. Of course, he gets burned right away, and that causes him to withdraw his hand. So he felt or had that sensation, the sensory, and then it went into his spinal cord, and it came out as a motor moving his hand away, and it's almost instantaneous. So that would be an example of a withdrawal reflex. Now the meninges of the spinal cord are going to be coverings around the spinal cord itself. There's going to be three of these coverings. They're fibrous, and they enclose the spinal cord, and they're continuous. They go all the way up into the brain. The innermost layer is called the pia matter. This wraps around the spinal cord and superiorly around the brain itself. It anchors the cord and meninges to the coccygeal first vertebrae distally. So if you picture the pia attaching to the spinal cord, but then leaving the spinal cord as it goes distally, but attaching all the way to the coccygeal vertebrae. So it goes past the lumbars, since the spinal cord stops at L1, goes all the way down to the sacrum, passes that, and finally goes and attaches to the coccyx. So oftentimes individuals will say, well, you know, the coccyx is just a vestigial vertebrae, it's not important. You know, it used to be a tail, some people even say. I don't know how true that is. But the fact is that it is significant because your pia mater actually attaches right there. So if the coccyx were to be out of place, it could cause problems with the pia, which then could cause problems with the spinal cord. So it's a significant vertebrae. We really don't have anything in our body that's not significant. Now the middle layer is going to be called the arachnoid matter. And the arachnoid matter is so named because it's oid, which means like. And arachna, of course, is going to be the term for a spider. So it's like a spider. And it's like a spider because of the fact that it has the orientations of the spine that looks very, very similar to a spider's web. What happens is that the arachnoid matter attaches to the pia. So if we were to pull the arachnoid matter off of the pia, we would see that there's going to be little ligaments that are going to be attaching to the pia. We call these denticulate ligaments because they look like teeth. So you pull that back, and also you have the nerve roots that are there as well. So you pull that back with the denticulate ligaments and with the nerve roots, and it looks just like a spider's web in there. So it's aptly named the arachnoid. Now the space is going to be underneath, the one we just described, that space is going to be between the pia and the arachnoid. It's going to be called the subarachnoid space. This is a gap, and this gap is going to be filled with cerebrospinal fluid. Cerebrospinal fluid is going to be flowing in the subarachnoid space all through the spine and then up into the brain as well. Now the outermost layer is going to be called the dura mater. And mater means mother, so it's going to be durable or tough. So it's really a tough mother. And that's what the membrane is going to be. And the epidural space, or the area outside or on top of, epi means on top, right? On top of the dura is going to be the epidural space, and this space is often used for anesthesia, particularly during childbirth. So they will put an analgesic into the spine at the lower part, let's say around the sacral area, usually the sacral hiatus, which is that little hole that's in the sacrum. They inject that in there, and then the anesthesia goes around the epidermis, or sorry, the epidural space, goes around the epidural space, and then that causes analgesia, and the person can't feel their legs, and they really can't feel very well their pelvis either, so it's going to help with childbirth, to decrease the discomfort. So because we have the pia and the arachnoid and the dura, we call this a pad around the spinal cord. That's the way we remember. From deep, the pia, to superficial, the arachnoid and dura. Inflammation of the meninges is going to be called meningitis. That itis tells us it's inflammation, so we're going to be getting that from, usually from bacterial infections. Now, the meninges of the spinal cord are going to have, well, if we just picture it, like, for instance, if we're going from the outside in, if we wanted to do a procedure, let's say we want to put analgesics in the epidural space, we would put the needle into the skin and then ultimately go on the outside of the spinal cord and just inject in the epidural space. We also could go further and try to get some cerebral spinal fluid deeper in the subarachnoid space. That subarachnoid space, then we would have to go through the epidural space, we'd have to go through the dura, then we would get into the subarachnoid space. Now, we would not want to go any further, although we could if we wanted to, if we are going to be in an area that's going to be safe. The area that's going to be safe is going to be below L1. So to be extra safe, they prefer to go like at L5, S1 area. So all that's going to be there is just the remnants of the cauda equina. So you still need the person awake so that if you do jab one of the nerves, they'll say, hey, I feel it in my toe. Then you know you have to back off. And then usually the nerve moves and then you're able to get into that space. It's sort of like having spaghetti, if you've ever made spaghetti, and you try to take a fork and actually jab one of the spaghettis to see whether or not it's done. And usually you can get it, or sometimes you can't because it'll get out of the way. So that's a lot like the cauda equina. So placing a needle in the subarachnoid space is called a spinal tap. Used to diagnose pathologies. Also, so that would be taking cerebral spinal fluid out. We can also put stuff in, such as drugs, into it there as well. So putting stuff in. Either one's going to cause a headache because the cerebral spinal fluid is going to cause a cushioning of our brain. So if you put more fluid in there, that's going to put pressure on the brain. And we know that nerves hate pressure. But if you take the fluid out, now you don't have enough cushioning. So you're going to get a headache either way. So the spinal tap must be given below L1, and we know why that is. An epidural is usually used for anesthesia. So what's the matter? Kinds of matter are going to be white matter, which is going to be myelinated. Gray matter is going to be unmyelinated. Notice this is with two T's. This is matter, not matter, as we talked about before with the pia, the arachnoid, and the dura matter. This is a different kind of matter. This is going to be in the spinal cord itself. So the white matter is going to be myelinated. And why is it white? Because of the fact that it has fat. So myelin is going to be composed of fat. So that's why it's white. The area of the axon or of our aardvark, of his head, is not going to be covered in fat. Only his nose is covered in fat. So therefore the gray matter will represent the soma or the body of the nerve or the head of our aardvark. So that's the reason it's gray, is because it has no fat. And then, of course, there's BC, which is our alma mater, or our academic mother. More on matter. The spinal cord has a shape to it, a gray matter shape, and that's going to be in the shape of an H, or some people call it a butterfly. It's surrounded by white matter. As we go superior, though, and get into the brain, we see just the opposite happens. We have gray matter on the outside and white matter on the inside. So it flips. And this is easy to remember because you remember that people call your brain the gray matter. They're just thinking about what they see when they just take a brain out of the skull. And it indeed is gray. So that gray matter of the skull then represents the heads of aardvarks. And the white would be the nose of aardvarks. So if you get the idea that we have really the nerve starting to go from the brain to the spinal cord, that makes it easier to understand. So the spine is going to be gray on the inside. It's a little butterfly. And it's going to be white on the outside. So, and the brain is going to be just the opposite. When we look at a cross-section of the spinal cord, we see that we have the gray matter shaped like a butterfly. And there's going to be really three areas that we're going to be concerned with. We have one area that's going to be sticking out of the white matter. This is going to be called the dorsal horn, also called the posterior horn. As we go just on the other side then of the dorsal horn, we see a rounded area, and this is going to be called the anterior horn or ventral horn. Then on some parts of the spine, particularly the thoracic spine, we'll see an outgrowth just lateral to these two dorsal and ventral horns. And this would be considered the lateral horns. So the gray matter then is going to be divided into these three areas. Now the columns are going to be in different areas of the spinal cord, but they're going to be in the white matter. if we look at the dorsal horns, the gray matter, and look between them, we'll see that there's going to be four columns. These four columns are called the dorsal columns. We have two dorsal columns on the left, two dorsal columns on the right, separated by the posterior median sulcus. So this is called the posterior columns. We'll talk more about that later. We also have lateral columns, and also we also have posterior columns, but we're not concerned with that right now, and nor will we ever be in the future. The most important columns are going to be our dorsal columns. Once again, they're going to be between the two dorsal horns. Now, gray matter, as we already talked about, are going to be the neuronal cell bodies, or the heads of the aardvarks. The white matter are going to be the myelinated axons, or the nose of our aardvark. So the gray matter is divided into horns, as we already talked about. Notice that the posterior horn sticks right through the white matter. So it's as if it posts itself. It's as if it's like an NFL goalpost. It actually is in the ground. So too, these posts go right through the white matter. But notice that the ventral horns do not. They're just rounded and they have white matter all around them. Now, the dorsal root ganglion is going to be along the area of the spinal nerve. And this is going to be on the dorsal part. So it's going to be coming from the dorsal horn. And we're going to be having a collection of nerve cell bodies in the ganglia. We think of it as a gang of aardvark's heads. So it's going to be a gang of the cell bodies, of all the sensory neurons that send their messages to the central nervous system. So we prick our finger, that information is going to go into the dorsal horn, because that's a sensory information. And because you have the heads of aardvarks there, they of course are going to be synapsing with other axons. So the sensory nerve axons in the tip of your finger actually have their cell bodies back in the dorsal root ganglion. And then you're going to have an aardvark taking the information to the spinal cord, and then you're going to have an aardvark taking it right up to the brain so that you can perceive that. Now the gray matter in the spinal cord, we're going to use some gross oversimplifications, but it's good for our purposes. But if you were a neuroanatomist, you would not approve of this, but for our purposes, this is going to be just fine. If we picture the gray matter in the spinal cord, we picture the very, very middle, and this is called the gray commissure. So that's where the two sides of the butterfly come together, as if that were like the body of the butterfly and his wings were the posterior, anterior, and lateral horns on either side. So the gray commissure is really what connects the right side to the left side of the spinal cord's gray matter. But if we were just to be general and just take a line right through the gray commissure, anything that's going to be posterior to that is going to be totally sensory. Anything that's anterior to that will be motor. So if you picture the posterior horn, we expect that to be sensory, and the anterior horn we expect to be motor. Now our spinal tracts, a tract is going to be really a nerve. We talk about nerves in our peripheral nervous system, like for instance, we have a nerve that goes from our neck to our hand, and it causes certain things to occur there. We also have nerves that go from our hand to our spine, which causes things to occur there as well. So we get sensory from our nerves coming from our hand to our spine. Then we have motor from the nerves going from our spine to our hand. Now, once the information gets to the spinal cord or goes from the spinal cord, it's got to either ascend or descend in the spinal cord. If it ascends, then it's going to be sensory. So an ascending tract comes from the periphery to head up and are called sensory, or they're also called afferent. So afferent, afferent, or sensory are going to be the synonymous terms. So we have nerves in the periphery, but then we have nerves in the spinal cord that go up in tracks, as if it were like a railroad. So we have railroad tracks that are coming up. We also have railroad tracks that are going down in our spinal cord. They're still nerves, but because they are arranged in sort of bundles and tracts. We call them tracts. So the descending tracts, or the descending nerves within the spinal cord, are going to head down and go out to the periphery. These guys are going to be called motor tracts. They're also going to be called efferent, or exiting. So efferent for exiting, afferent for affinity for or attraction. That A can be for attraction or affinity for. And efferent for exiting. So one's going to exit the spinal cord, one's going to go to the spinal cord. So the one that's going to is called the ascending or the afferent. And the one that's leaving the spinal cord is called the descending or efferent. Now, decussation is a phenomenon of crossing fibers. So when fibers cross in the spinal cord or in the brain stem, we call that phenomenon decussation. Now, second grade student knows that everything on our right side, like that we feel with our right hand, really comes from the left side of the brain. And everything on our left side really comes from the right side of the brain. So everybody knows that, but they don't know why. And the reason that that is because of the phenomenon of decussation. Decussation is going to be where we don't put all our eggs in one basket. We want things to cross, or our Creator wanted things to cross, so that we could have a phenomenon of what we would call redundancy. And redundancy is a phenomenon that occurs in the nervous system. And redundancy means that you're going to be having a overlap. So it's going to become redundant. You're going to be doing over and over. And that's okay, because if one part of the spine happens to be injured, then all the parts of the spine are not injured, because things are crossing back and forth. You can't get everything at once, which is excellent. Now, there's a contralateral means that the origin and destination are going to be on the opposite sides, whereas ipsilateral are going to mean it's going to be on the same side. So contralateral would be what we just described. Your right hand is really felt by your left brain, and your left hand is really felt by your right brain. That's contralateral. Whereas some individuals, you'll see that they'll have, like, for instance, a trauma, a stroke, for instance, to the right side of their brain. You'll notice that the whole left side will be paralyzed. This is going to be an ipsilateral problem, because you're going to be having the whole side gone, but it was due to a contralateral lesion. So that's a way of looking at that. Now, the motor and sensory parts of the brain are going to be very, very important for us to understand. So we just need to know a little bit of the brain anatomy. And that is, we first of all need to know that right in the middle of the brain is called the central sulcus. Now, a sulcus is going to be an area where we're going to be having a very shallow groove. The sulcus is created by two of the gyri. So a gyrus on one side and a gyrus on another, or gyri, these guys are going to fold in very, very slightly into a sulcus. So in our brains, we see that we have lots of gyri. The reason is because this is a folding of our brain tissue. So they're actually going to fold in, and they sort of, as if you were thinking of a whirling dervish who actually gyrates around, it's a very similar concept that it's going to be folding or sort of folded in. So it's gyrating, I guess, sort of gyrus in. And so it's going to be allowing for our brain to really be folded so it can fit inside of our skull. It's estimated that the brain probably would be like a big hat box. So we'd have this big, like, box on our heads if we did not have our brain being folded into gyri. So it's more convenient to have our skulls smaller. So all you need to do is just fold in the genetic material, neuronal material. So we have these folds are called gyri, or a gyrus, and they fold right in the middle of our brain. So if you were to picture, like, for instance, a coronal section of the brain, just like take your skull and divide it right in half, you would have a central sulcus right there, going from ear to ear, almost ear to ear. Or let's say the tip of your ears, So we'd have like a line there, and that'd be your central sulcus. In the front of the central sulcus would be called the pre-central gyrus. And behind the central sulcus will be called the post-central gyrus. So these two gyri are going to be very important. Your first pre-central gyrus is going to be where all of the motor comes from your brain. So all your movement is going to be coming from the pre-central gyrus. The post-central gyrus is going to be taking in all of the sensory. So all sensory stops at the post-central gyrus, or is perceived at the post-central gyrus. All motor starts at the pre-central gyrus. Very, very important concepts. How do we remember this? Well, first of all, we can remember that the Grand Prix is a motor race. So you think of the Grand Prix, you know it's going to be racing cars that have motors. So that's why you remember that, Grand Prix, pre-central gyrus. Also, post-central gyrus, think of the posterior columns or the posterior part of the spinal cord that we said was sensory. Now, speaking of sensory, we have a homunculus. And homunculus means a little man or something like that. And the homunculus is really going to be a representation of the parts of the body within the brain. And it also gives us a quantitative kind of concept, too. How many nerves are going to that area? So the bigger the structure that's shown, that means there's more nerves going to it. So if we look at the sensory homunculus, we see that we have a big face. We have very small feet, and we have very big hands. So this tells us that we're using a lot of nerves going to our face. Why is that? Well, we need to speak is one reason. We also have to eat. That's why we have such big hands and why we have so many nerves going to the mouth. We do not necessarily need to do much with our feet other than just walk. So we have the lion's share of the nerves, probably more than half, going to our hands and to our face, as you see from the sensory homunculus. Well, let's describe where the sensory homunculus would be. Since we know that sensory comes from what part of the brain? Oh, sorry, goes to what part of the brain? Yes, the post-central gyrus. Then picture taking that line that goes from the top of your ear to the other side of your ear. There's that line that's going to be a coronal cut through your skull. And that coronal cut, picture now, the front part of that, and what you would do is make a coronal section right through your face, right through your skull, and take off the front of your face. And look at your brain now. That would be your post-central gyrus. And this would then be half of your brain that you would be looking at when you look at the sensory homunculus. So you can see, for instance, that if a person has a stroke, and if they have it right inside of the medial longitudinal fissure, we see that they're going to have a problem with their leg or their foot or their hip. If you have a massive stroke that's going to be going over more laterally now into the hand, we can see that they're going to not be able to use their hand or foot, and this then would be more of a massive stroke, and you can see how that could occur. Now this would be sensory. They would not be able to feel in these areas because this is a sensory homunculus. If they had a similar situation with the motor homunculus, we can see how that could be manifest too in a stroke of the whole top part of the brain. How do we talk about the motor homunculus? Well, remember the motor homunculus is going to be the pre-central gyrus. So we take that same line that's going to be cutting our head all the way from one top of our ear to the other. That's the central sulcus. And we're going to be now taking of the front of our face off and looking at our brain. But remember, that's the post-central gyrus or the sensory homunculus. What we have to do is turn our hand around so that we can look at the part of our face that we pulled off. And looking at that brain now, that would be the pre-central gyrus or the motor aspect. And we see the same phenomena. We see that the lion's share of the motor nerves are going to our tongue, are going to our face for vocalization, so we can speak, and also into our hand, so we can eat. So we have a lot of nerves that are dedicated to just speech. Let's talk about a little fun things on how the neurons work. Neurons that control your right arm and your right leg dwell near each other in the what gyrus of the left side of your brain. Remember, neurons that control your right arm and right leg, okay, they're going to be in your pre or post central gyrus. Your pre. Remember, we're talking motor here. So now, polish the desk with a clockwise circular motion with your right hand. Now start your right hand to go clockwise, or your right foot to go clockwise as well. So you'll notice that when your neurons controlling your arm and leg are near each other, they work well together. You should be able to do this with no problem. Now do the same thing with your hand, still go clockwise, but now reverse the direction of your right foot, go counterclockwise. And you'll see that that's fairly difficult to do. Why? Well, it's because when neurons near each other are called on to do different work, they disturb each other. But you can have neighbors across town. Your left arm and left leg are across town in the what? Precentral gyrus. The right precentral gyrus. From your right and left arm and leg. So your left arm and your left leg are across town from your right arm and your right leg. So because of that, if you were to use your left arm to go clockwise to buff or to polish your table, so that's going to be your left arm, now it's going clockwise. This time if you rotate your right leg counterclockwise, you have no problem. Why is this? Well, it's because you're using your right side of your brain to go clockwise with your left hand. You're using your left side of your brain to go counterclockwise with your right leg. So because they're across town, they're not going to be disturbing each other. An abbreviated version would be, while you're sitting at your desk, lift your right foot off the floor and make a clockwise circle. Now while doing this, draw the number 6 in the air with your right with your right hand, and you see that your foot will change direction. Why? Because your right hand and your right leg are in the same area of your brain, and they're going to cause some irritation.